Okay, so let me begin by thanking the organizers for organizing this workshop and also giving me an opportunity to present this work here. So I've been asked to talk about some work I did a while ago with in collaboration with Alan Adams and Savdeep Sethi. It's HTH0309. And so this is relevant to this workshop because I'll be telling you some things about N equals 1 quantifications in 4 dimensions of the superstring. So here's roughly an outline of what I'll be doing for the next 1 hour. I'll be giving you some introduction and motivation for why zero-to duality might be an important thing to look at, and then I'll review in brief detail zero-to superspace because that will be relevant for what I'll be telling you, the superspace structure. And then I'll be telling you the statement of the perturbative duality. Then I'll tell you the possible non-perturbative corrections and hence the exact statement of the Wolschmidt duality. I'll make some general statements about the vacuum structure and I'll tell you a few examples. This will roughly depend on the amount of time I'll have in the end. And finally, I'll present some conclusions and some open questions. Okay, so let me start with introduction and motivation. So what is the basic plan? The basic plan is to consider compactifications of superstring theory to 4 dimensions and try to get N equals 1 supersymmetry to build realistic models of a string magnification. And one such scenario which you might wonder and try to consider is compactifications of the heterotic string on Calabi-Yau threefold. So this is something which is an old subject, and I'll be starting by telling you a few things which are known about it. So you can study heterotic string theory as a Wolschmidt superconformal field theory with N equals 2-2 superconformal invariants. So the fact that it's 2-2 tells you that there are two right-moving supercharges and two left-moving supercharges, and so it's a non-chiral Wolschmidt conformal field theory, and because it has equal number of left and right moving supercharges. And you can also study mirror symmetry in this context. It was originally proposed by Green and Plesser over a decade ago. And so in a nutshell, what is the statement of mirror symmetry? It tells you that to topologically completely distinct targets, completely distinct spaces leads to the identical effective space-time physics. And let me tell you two interpretations of this duality, which are of course related. One, you can have the interpretation of this duality from the target space point of view, that is from the point of view of the Calabi-Yau threefold. So there are certain deformations, as you all know, of this Calabi-Yau threefolds, which do not cost energy, and these are the complex structure deformations and the Keller structure deformations. And the statement of mirror symmetry is that the complex structure deformations and Keller structure deformations just get interchanged under this symmetry. And so the question is, okay, so this is the interpretation from the space-time point of view. So what is the interpretation of this duality from the Wolschmidt point of view? So from the Wolschmidt point of view, as I told you, I'm talking about N equals 2-2 superconformal field theory, and it's natural to ask what this duality corresponds to. And this duality at the Wolschmidt level corresponds to the following transformation. You take elements of the CC chiral ring. Maybe I'll move this transparency a bit up. You take elements of the CC chiral ring. So these are elements of the ring which are annihilated by Q bar plus and Q bar minus, which are plus and minus refer to the right and left moving supercharges. And these are the elements of the chiral ring which are annihilated by Q bar plus and Q bar minus. And then the other elements which are the AC chiral ring elements, which are annihilated by Q plus and Q bar minus. So the only difference is here for the left mover, it's the same, Q bar minus on both sides. For the right movers, these are annihilated by Q bar plus, whereas for the left, where this is annihilated by Q plus. And so the statement of mirror symmetry is that the elements of the CC chiral ring and the elements of the AC chiral ring are interchanged under this duality. And so you can say at the Wolschmidt level, what are you doing? I mean, because it's a 2-2 superconformal field theory, it has a U1 right mover, right moving symmetry as well as a U1 left moving symmetry. And you see that when going from Q bar plus to Q plus, all you're doing is you are interchanging the sign of J plus, which is the U1 right moving symmetry of this N equals 2-2 superconformal algebra. So So what does this tell you? So one statement which you can make right in the beginning is that as a space-time interpretation, it looks pretty complicated. It was interchanging the scalar and complex structure deformations of the Calabi-Yau threefold. Whereas from the world shape interpretation, it looks way simpler. So it's just, you have this 2-2 conformal field theory, and all you're doing is changing the sign of a right-moving even charge when you're going from the CC to the AC chiral ring. And so the question is, can you understand this duality as a world shape duality? And let me tell you what has been done basically in this context for 2-2 compact configurations with heterotic substring. So this is a review, this has been explained before also. So in 2-2 compactifications of the heterotic string, you are starting with a gauge group E6, and you further break it down by Wilson lines and so on. And this is the case where you embed the spin connection in the gauge connection. In other words, you start from this E8 gauge group, and you break it to SU3 times E6, and you embed the spin connection equals to the gauge connection to start with a gauge group E6. And this is what is termed as standard embedding. So the question we would like to ask is, what are more general compactifications? Can you do better, and can you have more general compactifications? And of course, the question you want to ask is in the space-time theory, and also naturally, can you pose this problem as a question of some duality of some world-shift superconformal field theory? And so here is what the goal is. We want to consider D equals 4, N equals 1 theories with world-shift supersymmetry 0, 2, hence the title of this talk. So you see from the notation, it has two right-moving supercharges and absolutely no left-moving supercharges. And so you see the case of this 2-2 duality is a particular special case of this class of dualities. And actually, this 0, 2 is good enough for n equals 1 supersymmetry in d equals 4. You can actually construct the space-time supercharge from the right-moving U1. You just need a U1 to construct this supercharge. This is some old work in the 80s by Boucher, Kent, Friedan, Schenker, Witten, and also Banks, Dixon, Friedan, and Martinik. So, so now you have the motivation, according to what I told you, to consider 0-2 compactifications. And so, what are we doing here from the space-time point of view? We are taking the spin connection, but we are no more setting it equal to the gauge connection. In other words, this is the so-called non-standard embedding. And it turns out that it's you can obtain gauge groups SU5 or SO10 rather than the E6, which I told you about for 2-2 compactifications, and you can break them down further. So as you can see, these are probably more realistic models of superstring compactifications as they are natural gauge groups that study in grand, one studies when considering a grand unified field theory. So okay, so now the question is, what is the world-shift version of this generalization of 2-2 duality? And can this be thought of as a generalization of mirror symmetry also? Okay, so so let me start with telling you what data you need to study 0-2 compactifications of the heterotic string. So I'll be focusing on a Kähler manifold M, which is my internal compact space. And because the heterotic string theory has gauge degrees of freedom, there'll be a holomorphic vector bundle, which I'll denote by V, living on this base space. And this will carry the gauge degrees of freedom. I mean, you know why it's holomorphic, and also it has to be stable, so that basically follows from the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau equations. And of course, there are some constraints for this choice of this vector bundle and the choice of this base space. And here are the constraints. I'll just review this quickly. So one constraint is that the first Chern class of the tangent bundle of the manifold must be zero. So at the world-shift level, this is the condition for conformal invariance. And you know this is the condition that this manifold via Calabi-Yau. We shall relax it in general, of course, because we'll be considering toy models to study for this duality which we propose, and then we can just we need not look at conformal models in general. Of course, for models which we, I mean, for realistic string compactifications, we'll have to further restrict ourselves to models with first-order class vanishing. Okay, so for the holomorphic vector bundle, you need the first-order class to be 0 mod 2. And this mod 2 comes up because you need to allow the presence of spinners, and this mod 2 condition is essentially related to the fact that this is how you define the Stiefel-Whitney class, which is the topological abstraction. And there's one more condition which you need in order to study this compactification. And I'll again tell you physically what this corresponds to. So it tells you that the second churn character of the tangent bundle has to be equal to the second churn character of the holomorphic vector bundle. Now you can see what it boils down to for Clavier threefolds, where you know that the first churn class vanishes. For the first churn class for the holomorphic vector bundle, I'm taking it to be zero, not only mod 2, but zero. And the, using the definition that the second churn character is actually half the first churn class square minus the second churn class, and the first churn class has vanished, so you see it boils down to equality of the second churn classes. And you know the statement that DH is actually non-zero, but it's trivial in cohomology. It's equal to trace of R square minus 1 by 30th trace of F square. I mean, this factor comes in because the one is tracing the fundamental, another is tracing the adjoint. So I've differentiated by a small t and a large t. But anyway, so this statement of this equality of the second churn classes is equivalent to the statement that this is trivial in cohomology, and these measure the second churn classes of the tangent and vector bundle, respectively. So now, before moving on to zero-two theories, let me tell you some potential sources of problems. It was generically believed that compactifications of zero-two type can be problematic. Essentially due to Wolschitt instant terms. You take the Euclidean Wolschitt and construct holomorphic maps wrapping it on P1s in the target space, and this was generically believed to lead to generation of a space-time superpotential which can destabilize the theory. In other words, this conformal invariance is broken at a non-perturbative level. And this was the work of Dine, Seiberg, Wen, and Witten quite a while ago. And however, so essentially the argument was that the vanishing of non-vanishing of this space-time superpotential, which was destabilizing the theory, was essentially due to the absence of certain left-wing fermion zero modes. And the other, in other words, if you actually had those left-wing fermion zero modes left, then this superpotential would vanish and the theory would continue to be stable. And the precise mathematical criteria to avoid this destabilization was formulated by Distler and Green, where they had a mathematical condition for splitting of this bundle into certain sub-bundles over the holomorphic maps, and so they had a precise condition for stability. So anyway, so this might be very hard to actually explicitly work out for all possible cases, but we'll focus on certain theories, namely those theories which can be realized as infrared limits of gauge linear sigma models only. So these are the theories I'll be considering in my talk all throughout. And there, I'll be talking about the Wolschitt duality, as I stressed earlier. So the question is the Wolschitt theory stable? So in other words, is a non-perturbative superpotential generated for the Wolschitt field theory? And this was some work which I did with Savdeep Sethi, and where we showed that no such non-perturbative superpotential can be generated, essentially by using Kunish anomaly arguments. And similar conclusions had also been reached earlier by, in certain sense, by Sylvester and Whitman, later by Beasley and Whitman. So finally, before going on to 0-2, I want to make a few final comments about this 2-2 dualization. And in this transparency, I'll review 2-2 duality. So once again, this duality is best understood for theories which can be realized as gauge linear sigma models in the UV. So you construct gauge linear sigma models which flow in the IR to the target spaces you're looking for. And this gauge linear sigma model was first constructed, I guess, by Witten. And you can understand this 2-2 mirror symmetry as a Wolschitt 2-2 duality. So this was the work by Hori and Wafa, and also some earlier work had been done in this regard by Morrison and Plesser. So I'll be very schematic here because I just want to get a few salient features across to you. The point is the following. You construct this complex boson phi, which is its absolute value rho, and a phase, which is given by this curly phi, and you couple it to a U1 gauge field. And you consider the action for the phase phi. I mean, you know the action for the absolute part is just derivative rho square. And the action for the phase is given by this. It's rho square times this structure, derivative of phi, plus the gauge field square. And the point is, we would like to understand this as a t-duality, but in the presence of this gauge field. I mean, you see, this, there's a derivative of phi here, and so there's a symmetry along this periodic coordinate, and which we want to t-dualize on. So the point is the following. Let me start with this Lagrangian L prime, where I have an auxiliary vector field, B with this action, B square and B coupled to this same structure which you get here. And you want to integrate out B mu, and you can easily see that this actually leads to this action. And the other way to do this integrating out is to integrate out phi, which tells you that DB is 0. In other words, B is D phi. And actually, it turns out you can see that this theta here is actually a periodic coordinate just by the fact that it's t-duality if you were to set the gauge field to zero. And you get the dual Lagrangian, which is 1 over rho square importantly, and derivative of theta square and this coupling. So you see, at the end of the day, what do you have? You have this original Lagrangian, which has this coupling of this del mu phi at a radius rho, and you have this final theory where you have this del mu theta but at a radius 1 by rho with this coupling. So this is essentially what we have done, is t-duality in a gauge field background. And the only things I basically want you to remember from here is that a theta is actually a periodic coordinate. A theta is neutral, it doesn't couple to the, it's not charged under this gauge symmetry. And it's a dynamical theta angle coupling to F mu nu. In other words, if theta were just a constant, then you could see this field would, this term would go away, and this would just have a coupling to the instanton density in the 1 plus 1 dimension field theory. So this can be generalized to 2-2 superspace as well, and this leads to 2-2 duality. And this was precisely what Hori and Wafa did. So let me in a nutshell tell you what that is. Okay, so here is the idea of Hori and Wafa. You start with a 2-2 gauge linear figure model in the UV description of the theory, and you dualize, basically along the lines which I told you, but in full 2-2 superspace, and you get Landau-Ginzburg theory in the UV. And then what you do is you RG flow both sides of this transparency to the infrared, and you see what kind of theories you get. Here you can see that the theories which you get is a nonlinear figure model, and the dual theory here which you get is Landau-Ginzburg theory, but it's an orifold Landau-Ginzburg theory. It essentially appears because some of the chiral superfields which you have here carry charges other than one under this gauge symmetry, and so it boils down to taking orifold of the, of the Landau-Ginzburg theory. And these two IR theories, this nonlinear figure model and this Landau-Ginzburg orifold field theory, are dual, and these are the mirror pairs. So that was what was done by Hori and Wafa. As an example, they constructed the most well-known Clavijau threefold, the quintic in P4 and the dualized. Again, you dualize in the UV, do the RG flow to the IR, and see what kind of theory you get in the low energy limit. And then the dual theory was the Z5 to the 4 orbifold Landau-Ginzburg superconformal field theory. And this was basically the original model constructed by Green and Plesser. And in this way, for the 2-2 theories, at least you can basically derive all the known cases of mirror symmetry. You use the dualities between Clavijau, Landau-Ginzburg, and Minion models to essentially map out the whole known space of mirror pairs. So before I proceed with 0-2, I would want to make a few comments. This is true as well as for 2-2 as well as for as also for 0-2. The first joint class of the tangent bundle always I'll be restricting to cases which are greater than or equal to 0. But I'll be not looking at gauge linear figure models where the first joint class of the tangent bundle is negative. So if it's actually precisely 0, it's good, it's conformal, and then a gauge linear figure model will RG flow to a nonlinear figure model with target space Clavijau. Might be compact, might be not non-compact, depending on whether you have a hypersurface, for example, embedded in some projective space. And if the first joint class is positive, the gauge theory is asymptotically free and it flows to a strong coupling in the IR, and that's okay. It's importantly that it's weakly coupled in the UV. And in the in the other case which I leave out, with the case with the first joint class negative, the gauge theory is strongly coupled in the UV. And here the dualization is not expected to work. And all the results I'll be telling about, or I told you about 2-2 as well as for 0-2, they just do not work in the cases where the first joint class of the tangent bundle is negative. In the gauge linear figure model approach, the first joint class is basically measured by the charges of the right movers of the chiral superfield. So if the sum of the charges is negative, this dualization just won't work. There are known examples also. And again, I want to stress that I'm restricting only to theories which can be realized in the UV as a gauge linear figure model. And finally, I'll be considering theories without superpotential in gauge linear figure model. This is one obstacle which should be some avenue for future research. How to consider dualization in theories with superpotential. In 2-2 theories, also explicit dualization cannot be done with superpotential. But there, basically, what happens is you can still get around it by basically saying that in the original theory, in terms of the charged chiral superfield, we are looking at elements of the CC chiral ring, and the superpotential will be deformations of the CC chiral ring. But in the final theory, it's in terms of, in the Landau-Ginzburg theory is in terms of uncharged twisted chirals and which are elements of the AC chiral ring, and so possible deformations of the CC chiral ring cannot basically influence the AC ring results. And so they basically work, but you know, in 0-2 there is nothing like a twisted chiral and chiral, and so we are not sure of what happens when you turn on superpotentials in the original theory. Anyway, so before moving on to the 0-2 duality, let me give you a brief review of super 0-2 superspace. As I told you, it has two right-moving supercharges, so clearly there are two supercharges, Q plus bar, and of course there are the superderivatives D plus bar, and there's a right-moving U1R symmetry, which is part of the 0-2 conformal algebra. And what are the various multiplets I'll be looking at? Let me just tell you the multiplet structure. I'll have a gauge multiplet for this U1 gauge theory. It can be split up into two superfields. There's V, which has this part of the photon and this gauge inverse and the D term, and psi, which has only the right moving part of the photon. They can construct a gauge invariant, gauge covariant derivative and the field strength. So the field strength here is a fermionic superfield. Its lowest component is a fermion, and its theta plus middle component is D minus the field strength. And you can construct the action for the gauge theory, which is just gamma bar gamma integrated over superspace. And because it's a U1 theory, you can also have a Fowler plus term. And this is the structure of the term. So it's a superpotential term, and hence it's integrated only over the chiral part of the superspace. And it's T times integral over the field strength, where T is actually IR plus theta by 2 pi. So so these are the parameters, the theta angle and the R parameter here. You can also have a chiral superfield, which I'll denote by phi. It has a scalar component phi and a right-moving fermionic component, which is which has this chirality constraint. So here I wrote a curly D instead of the D here, because I'm looking at gauge theory, and one can construct gauge covariant derivatives, and this is what I have here. So the only point I wanted to remember from here is that this phi is described actually a tangent bundle. In other words, these scalars here are basically the directions of the space. And for the Fermi, for the Fermi superfield, this is a fermionic superfield, and the lowest component is again a left-moving fermion now, and there's an auxiliary field, which is the middle component, and there's also a theta plus bar component, which is very important for what I'm going to tell you later. And this just doesn't give you d bar plus to be zero, but it gives you that d bar plus gamma is actually proportional to this E here. And this Fermi superfield is important because this is going to describe your holomorphic vector bundle. And it has an obvious action, which is integrated over whole superspace, gamma bar gamma. And so just a minor comment, what happens in 2-2 theories? I mean, actually in 2-2 theories, this E actually is fixed to a very specific value. It is linear in phi, and there's another neutral 0-2 chiral superfield, considering sigma and lambda bar plus, which enters into the definition of E. And finally, what about the superpotential? The superpotential is again integrated over the chiral half of the superspace, and is of the form of fermion times a bosonic superfield, which satisfies the chirality constraint that EAJA dot product is zero. And the only other result which I want to review here is the formula for the potential. So the formula for the potential has the following contributions. There's a D-term contribution, D squared, and there are other contributions coming from EA and JA, with D given by R minus this object, sum over the mod phi square for all the chiral superfields. And a supersymmetric vacuum is given by D equals EA equals JA equals zero. Okay. So now having reviewed this, let me move on to the statement of the perturbative duality. So here basically I'm starting with 0-2 duality. Okay, so I'll be deriving this without a superpotential, and you can go through the details, which I'll of course skip here, and get the following answers. So first let me dualizing only the chiral superfields, no Fermi superfields right now. So you start with this action, phi dagger, covariant derivative phi, and this is charged, as I explained earlier. And the dual theory will be in terms of uncharged chiral superfields, and this has this non-canonical kinetic term. You see, this is a del minus logarithm of y plus y bar times y minus y bar. And it actually gets a superpotential when you dualize. So this theory had no superpotential, but this has a superpotential, which is basically y coupled to the field strength. And you can see from what I explained way earlier was that this is essentially the coupling of the dynamical theta angle to the field strength here. I mean, this has this term theta times epsilon mu unit mu. And I'll be telling you about the duality map, which is a generalization of the mirror map for 2-2 theories, that you're forced to actually have the real part of Y to be positive definite, positive semi-definite, and the imaginary part of Y, which I explained earlier, is the theta angle, and it has to be periodic. And so let me also basically tell you the duality map. Essentially, boils down to starting from a cleverly chosen Lagrange and having some auxiliary fields where you can integrate out fields in two different ways and then equate the various components. And the duality map turns out to be the following. So from now on, these phis are all chiral superfields which carry charge, and the y's are neutral superfields which do not carry charge. The duality map is the following. Phi bar phi is y plus y bar by 2. So this was the earlier statement in transparency that the real part of y has to be positive semi-definite. And this is the other term relating derivatives in y to derivatives in phi. And now let me tell you how to dualize only Fermi multiples. So here again, the original theory had this Fermi superfields, gamma, which were charged, and this was the action. You can again dualize and getting again a non-canonical kinetic term, F bar F. So here gamma are the charged Fermis and F are the neutral Fermis. And again you get a superpotential. So the superpotential structure is very simple. It's just integral over the chiral part of superspace times the Fermi superfield. And it has this weird denominator. It actually can be written down kind of explicitly in the following way, that y, you have this E in the definition of a Fermi superfield, that D bar plus of gamma was proportional to E. And you can take E, E bar, and that becomes the definition of Y E plus Y E bar by 2. I mean, in generic cases, it's very difficult to write down Y E plus Y E bar in terms of the Y I's for the duals of the chiral superfields, except for some simple case. Say, for example, if I had E was phi to the n, then E bar E becomes phi bar phi, and phi bar phi using the mirror map is Y plus Y bar by 2. So you can explicitly write down Y E plus Y E bar in terms of the Y, but not always. And there's another important case which I want to focus on later, so let me mention that right now. So let me consider a neutral chiral superfield sigma, and let me consider this E object, which is a function which is linear in sigma and a random polynomial in the phis. Then actually in the dual theory, instead of just having a superpotential which was just F here, you can have a superpotential which is sigma times F by rescaling the fields away from here. And in general, dualizing chirals and Fermis together turns out to be difficult in the sense that, I mean, you can do the dualization, but it's difficult to write down the explicit mirror maps, which are basically the generalization of the 2-2 maps, except for some simple choices. But I'll roughly tell you what the map gets modified to. Okay, so what happens is this part of the map stays exactly as it were. This is phi bar phi is y plus y bar by 2. Whereas the other part of the map, connecting the two derivatives for the charged and uncharged superfields, gets a correction due to the Fermi superfield bilinears. And this is a new addition which is often difficult to write down explicitly. Anyway, so at the end of the day, all I want to tell you is what is the answer for the perturbative superpotential of the dual theory. The dual theory I'll be denoting by this tilde. So this is the perturbative superpotential. So this gamma times T was there from the original theory. This was just the phi Laplace term. And you have some extra terms which you got during dualization. So start with a theory with chiral superfields having charges QI and some Fermi superfields having charges QA. So the dual theory has this perturbative superpotential, its field strength coupled to QI, YI summed over plus the phi Laplace term, and sigma coupled to FA, QA, where you sum over the charges for the Fermi superfield. So this is the statement of the perturbative duality. So now let me go on to the possible non-perturbative corrections to this perturbative superpotential. And to start with, I'll be always restricting myself to consistent quantum field theories in the two-dimensional sense. In other words, I demand, it's a U1 gauge theory, so I demand U1 gauge anomaly cancellation. I mean, here you had a certain number of right-moving fermions from the chiral superfield, and you had a certain number of left-moving fermions from the Fermi superfield, which carried different charges. And so you have to just make sure that this vacuum polarization diagram vanishes when you sum over all chiral fermions. And from the two vertices, it's easy to see that the condition is that sum over the square of the charges for the right-moving fermions is equal to the sum over the left-moving charges for the left-moving fermions. And in terms of the geometric data, which I told you earlier, this actually boils down to the statement that the Chern character of the tangent bundle is equal to the Chern character of the holomorphic vector bundle. Okay, so the dualization which I told you, you start with some charged chiral phi and charged Fermi gamma A, and you end up with some neutral chiral yi and some neutral Fermi Fa. And the question is, what are the possible non-perturbative corrections to this perturbative superpotential? The answer is the following. They can be due to vortex instantons of the Abelian-Higgs model in the original theory. And so I'll be restricting myself to cases where E is of this form. It's a polynomial of the phi times the neutral chiral superfield. I mean, the other case where this neutral chiral superfield doesn't exist is just a special case where you think of giving it an expectation value, beta say. And you can go through a long song and dance and get the answer. So I'll just directly tell you the answer. Yeah. So you can essentially fix the instanton contributions by some global R symmetry arguments. You essentially give theta plus an R charge, and then that tells you that the field strength has to be R has to have a charge under this R symmetry as well, and E has to have a charge under R symmetry, and you give sigma an R charge. And then you can actually calculate the R charges for all the other superfields in the theory. And here is the and of course you demand holomorphy and analytic behavior when the field strength is turned off and so on. And here is the final exact answer. So this was something which I showed you in the previous transparency. This is just the perturbative statement of the duality. And here is the answer for the instanton correction. So mu is the mass scale. You have Fa and e to the minus yi. And this is some coefficients beta ia which are undetermined. And what happens in this 2-2 analysis? This 2-2 analysis, what happens is, well, I and A are summed over the same number of indices because you have same number of chirals and fermis. And this beta ij turns out to be delta ij. So this becomes Fi e to the minus yi. So here beta ia turns out to be model dependent. And it's very difficult to compute in general. I mean, the point you could compute them in the 2-2 theory was that E was linear in phi. And then basically you could, you know, the computing these coefficients essentially boils down to computing the fermion zero modes in the vortex instanton background explicitly. It's very easy to compute it for the right movers. I mean, you know it from, it's known for a while. But for generic choices of E, it's very difficult to write down the explicit fermionic left moving zero mode and actually do the integral to get these coefficients. So this is another important problem which Nistri probably thought about more, an exact computation of this beta IA, which is the numbers here. Probably this will involve techniques other than just instanton. Okay, so so now that I have told you the exact superpotential of the dual theory, first let me tell you a few other things about it. So I'll make some general statements about the vacuum structure of the theory. So as I'll show you, it often becomes easier to understand the vacuum structure in the dual theory, where essentially you have just a polynomial superpotential with no charge fields. I mean, this is, of course, also true often, more often than not in the case of these 2-2 theories. And so the claim is that for gauge linear figure models with charge fields, one can study the vacuum structure, and one can figure out exactly how the massless bosons and fermions behave, and of course how the superpotentials restrict to hypersurfaces in the ambient space. But this I'll kind of gloss over, and I'll go directly to some aspects of the low-energy dual theory. Okay, and I'll begin with the expression for the exact superpotential. So let me go back to the expression here. Okay, so just remember that here you have this term coupled to the field strength, and here you have the sum over the Fermi superfields coupled to sigma fields. That's all that I wanted to remember. Okay, so to consider the low energy theory in a Wilsonian sense, I have to integrate out the massive modes. And of course, the field strength multiplet has to be integrated out because it gets a mass E times the expectation value of phi, which is roughly E times square root R. This is just by super Higgsing. So field strength multiplet has to be integrated out. And now consider sigma. Sigma can possibly get a mass by this sort of a term in the action, where sigma couples to E with this mod square in the action. And there can be two cases here. One where E of phi is actually vanishing in the vacuum, then sigma continues to be massive and will survive in a low energy theory. On the other hand, if E of phi is non-vanishing in the vacuum, sigma gets a mass proportional to E of phi. And I will consider, restrict myself right now, only to the branch of solutions where E of phi actually gets an expectation value and when sigma becomes massive. I'll come back to the other branch. I'll have a few comments about this other branch later. So you see, we have to integrate out the two superfields sigma and the field strength multiplet. And from the previous transparency, yeah, I mean, let me just flash this once more. So when you have to integrate out this, and you have to integrate out this. And it gives you obvious answers for the low energy theory. You get this sum over the yi's has to give you minus it, which is the complexified scalar class. And sum over the fa's has to be equal to zero. So let me tell you something more detailed about vacuum structure. Let there be n chiral superfields in the original theory. So in this yi, I runs over 1 to n. And let there be 1 to m, Fermi superfields in the original theory. So here, this A index goes from 1 to m. And so from these two equations, you obviously get that you have n minus 1 independent yi's left because there was one equation among them, and m minus 1 independent fa's left in the low energy theory. Now you have to basically plug in these variables in the effective superpotential, which was mu beta ia fa e to the minus yi, and write them in terms of the independent f's and y's, which you get by solving the other two equations which I wrote down. And then you have to find a supersymmetric vacuum, which boils down to taking a derivative with respect to the independent Fermi superfields and setting it to zero for every choice of f. So clearly, I mean, because there were m minus 1 independent f's, you get m minus 1 such equations. But there were n minus 1 independent y's. So in the end, to study the vacuum equations are the following. You get m minus 1 equations in n minus 1 independent variables yi. And so you can have naturally three possibilities. I mean, in 2-2 cases, actually, m is equal to n. So I'll just talk about this briefly. So the first case is where the number of chirals is equal to the number of Fermis. In other words, n is equal to m. And we interpret this in the gauge linear figure model as the fact that the rank of the tangent bundle is equal to the rank of the holomorphic vector bundle. And you can see here you have as many equations as the number of unknowns. And so the y's are fixed, and you get isolated vacuum. And this is a Landau-Ginzburg theory as a vacuum structure. So the dual theory, you get isolated vacuum. This is the same as in the 2-2 case as well. So the other case is when the number of chirals is greater than the number of Fermis. So in this case, n is greater than m. In other words, the rank of the tangent bundle is greater than the rank of the vector bundle. And you see, then, because n is larger than m, you have lesser equations than unknowns. In other words, the yi's are not completely fixed, and some of them continue to be flat directions in the low energy theory. So what does this mean? I mean, from here, basically, we start drastically moving away from the structure of the 2-2 vacuum. I mean, the dual theory can actually be geometric. And the surface actually is a vacuum manifold. It might have some metric singularities, which I'll talk about briefly towards the end. And we expect associated dilaton growing up precisely at the locus of the metric singularity so that the whole field theory is perfectly smooth. And in the other case, where the number of chirals is greater than less than the number of Fermis, where n is less than m, so the rank of the tangent bundle is less than that of the holomorphic vector bundle, you have more equations than unknown. So generically, unless the equations are linearly dependent, which I'll talk about briefly, the solutions will be that y's go to infinity, because the terms involve e to the minus y. And so again, you have isolated vacuum structure and not some discrete term. However, you had, you know, larger number of equations than the number of variables, but if it can be so arranged that some of these equations become linearly dependent, the structure can drastically change. And you can then actually have a continuum surface as the vacuum manifold or even isolated points. And this is the kind of structure which really interpolates between the other two structures, where you're always guaranteed to have discrete points or a continuum as a vacuum solution. I mean, I'll consider some examples of this later. So the main issue is that the vacuum structure is clearly way richer than 2-2, where you could have only had this kind of vacuum structure and absolutely nothing else. And so now I'll consider some examples illustrating this various possibilities. So my motivation for telling you these examples is twofold. First of all, to highlight certain aspects of the vacuum structure which I talked about before, and also more importantly, to tell you about constructions of 0-2 dual pairs. So these are very simplistic examples which I'll be looking at. And hopefully you can go and follow it with me. So first, let me consider the simplest case. and probably the most natural case, where the number of chiral superfields is equal to the number of Fermi superfields. And let me consider a theory where you have n chiral superfields phi I and n Fermi superfields gamma I with exactly the same charges, qi, and ei, which is ci, sigma times phi I. In other words, this is not a very drastic deformation to the 2-2 theory, because if c were actually equal to root 2q, you would be exactly the 2-2 locus. But nonetheless, you have broken to 0-2 supersymmetry. And there's another, again, long song and dance you can go through, and you can compute the instanton coefficients exactly. I mean, I'm not going through the details, but basically what happens is, in this case, what you can do is, the analysis that you actually did to pick these coefficients was doing a large sigma analysis. So you take the lowest component field of this, which is just a boson, and fix it to a large non-vanishing value. And then basically in this case, you can see that the other chiral superfields and the Fermi superfields, both in the original and in the dual theory, get mass. So you can integrate out both of them independently, and you'll get some equation which should be the same for both. And that essentially helps you in fixing the instanton coefficient. And here the beta just turned out to be -1. And the exact dual superpotential terms are to be the following. You have this coupling to the field strength, which I've written down many times before, coupling to sigma, and the coefficients are all equal, so it's fi to the minus yi, and it's diagonal. Okay, so the dual theory has n chirals yi, and n Fermis fi, which are all, again, uncharged. And so the question is, I'll be restricting myself to simple models, which I can work out in front of you, essentially. What is the vacuum structure? Further, for simplicity, let me restrict to cases where all the charges are 1. It's easy to generalize for the other cases. And, of course, so what is the original theory? If all the charges are 1, you can easily see that the original theory flows in the IR to a 0 to CP n minus 1 target space, given by the vanishing of the D-term, essentially, and modding out with the U1 gate symmetry. And in the dual theory, again, you have to integrate out the field strength, which gives the mass E times square root R, and sigma, which gives the mass C times square root R. And again, the constraints which you get are this vanishes as well as this vanishes. So this is just written down by these two equations. And now the plan is to solve these equations, and of course these are not difficult to solve at all. Let me kind of quickly go through the solutions. So solve by setting y1 up to yn minus 1 equal to some theta parameters, theta 1 to theta n minus 1, and yn is IC plus the sum of the other thetas. F1 is some another Fermi superfield by C1. Fn minus 1 is Gn minus 1 by C1. And Fn is the sum such that the whole sum stands for us. And finally, this is Y has a periodic part which was, at this phase which was periodic. So let me define a single valued coordinate, xi equals e to the theta I. And in terms of this, let me write down the effective superpotential. So all I've done is just solve for these constraints in the Ys and Fs and written it down in terms of Xs and Gs. And here's what the answer which you get at the end of the day. You have sum over all the n minus 1 independent fields here, GIs, with this structure here, x by c minus e to the it times the product of the x's. And to find the supersymmetric vacua, you take the derivatives with respect to the g's, and you can see the xi's by ci's are going to be the same for every choice of I, and you set it equal to x by mu, I mean, because c actually has dimensions mu, my mass scale, and you can just solve for the vacuum equation. And the solution is the following. It's x to the n is mu to the n, e to the I, t, by product of the c's. And you can actually construct an RG invariant scale. You just look at the one loop running of t mu, and the RG invariant scale is given by lambda to the n is mu to the n, e to the I, t. And you can write down the equation finally as x to the n is lambda to the n by product of ci. If you are familiar with the 2-2 models, you can easily see directly that this is actually giving you the correct answer for the 2-2 Pn minus 1 chiral ring, where actually x to the n, but the c's are just 1, so x to the n becomes just the instanton, it just becomes proportional to e to the minus t. And here you can see we have actually got a generalization of the 0-2 chiral ring. And again, you can see how many supersymmetric vacua there are. I mean, these are questions which are probably way more complicated to answer in the original theory in terms of the charged chirals. So here you can see there are clearly n vacua given by the net root of this times this phase. And by the way, just as a curiosity, for arbitrary charges qi, let me restrict to cases where all the qis are positive so that the target space in the target spin nonlinear sigma model is compact. And you get, again, x is given by mu e to the I t, but sum over the charges instead of n. And this tells you that there are exactly sum over qi number of vacua. So this is one usefulness of this. And let me consider another more non-trivial example of this. This will be a relevant deformation of P1 times P1. And by relevant here, I mean actually in the sense of the renormalization group. Actually, you can work out that the tangent bundle of P1 times P1, the tangent bundle itself has 6 complex deformations. And I want to study this deformation. And so first, let me realize this space as a gauge linear figure model in a UV. So I need a P1 times a P1. So first, let me consider 2 gauge theories, U11 and U12, under which, under the first U1, there's phi1 and phi2, 2 chiral superfields which are charged. And there's another, I take 2 other Fermi superfields, gamma 1 and gamma 2, to have charged 1, 1, 1, 1. And under the other P1 is the same but with tildes. And I take 2 neutral superfields, sigma and sigma twiddles, which are neutral under both the U1s. And then I consider the choice of tangent bundle deformation. So, I mean, the details are irrelevant, but I just want to drive home a point, is that if you forget all these deformations, I'm just at the 2-2 locus. That is, E1 is sigma times phi1. And E2 is sigma times phi2, and E1 twiddle is sigma times phi1 twiddle, and E2 is sigma twiddle times phi2 twiddle. Now, what I do is I add some deformations to this, which are the following form. I mean, I take sigma twiddles to be here. Clearly, I can do that because they're neutral under this U1, and deform them by phi1 and phi2. And similarly, I couple here 2 sigmas instead of here, and I deform them by betas and beta primes. And because there are 8 complex parameters, but they can be projectively identified with the phis and the phi twiddles, we actually have 6 complex deformations. And these are basically the 6 relevant deformations of P1 times P1 tangent bundle. Okay, so let me tell you a bit about the vacuum structure. The vacuum structure is obvious, at least for these cases. You get a P1 from this equation, another P1, and the EIs and the EI twiddles have to be set to 0. Now, here's a point which I want to come back to. I mentioned it briefly in one of the transparencies ago, that clearly this has a solution with sigma equals, sigma twiddle equals 0, the obvious solution. We will be considering this. But there can be other branches of the solution where neither sigma nor sigma twiddle equals to 0. And this probably will lead to interesting branches of vacuum structure. This I won't have time to go into details. But what happens is you can have solutions where actually we construct a solution where neither sigma and sigma twiddle are 0, but it turns out that they are proportional to each other. And this can be thought of as kind of such a degeneration limit, because if you actually do the analysis for the massless fermion, for every choice of this sigma from the Yukawa couplings, you get an equation as a constraint, and that basically reduces the rank of the holomorphic vector bundle by 1. And when, so in other words, I mean, for generic choices, you would come down in the rank by 2, but when they become proportional, you come down in rank only by 1. So you can see a discrete a change in the number of ranks, number of units by which the rank decreases. And, but however, I'll be restricting myself to the case where the vacuum solution is sigma equals sigma twiddle equals 0. And so of course, for generic perturbations which I talked about, it's difficult to solve it. But let me focus on one particular case where you can exactly solve again for the instanton coefficients and tell you the answer. So here's what I'll do. I keep the E twiddles exactly at the 2-2 locus. So I'm really not doing something to the second P1. But for the first P1, this was what I would have at the 2-2 locus, and I deform it by 2 parameters, epsilon1 and epsilon2. And so basically, with these parameters, they break supersymmetry from 2-2 to 0-2. And so what is the field content in the dual theory? Corresponding to phi1, phi2, gamma 1, and gamma 2, you have 4 neutral fields, 2 chirals and 2 fermis, and a tilde one for the second P1. And again, here, one can compute the instanton coefficients exactly, essentially because of the fact that E's are linear in phi's, and you can do a large sigma analysis and do the path integral exactly to compute defective action. And here's the answer. I won't write down the perturbative part that I've written out several times. And here's the answer for the non-perturbative part. You have this diagonal coupling fi e to the minus yi for the roughly the first duals of the first P1, and the tildes for roughly the duals of the second P1. But you can have this non-trivial coupling between the fermis corresponding to the first P1 and the duals of the chirals corresponding to the second P1. And you can work through the details, and there can be 2 possible answers to the superpotential with epsilon1, F2, epsilon2, F1 coupling, or the other case where epsilon1 and epsilon2 are interchanged. And you can again work out the vacuum configuration. You can solve for this constraint for the y's and the s, and similar for the other p1s, that is for the tilde variables. And finally, at the end of the day, you define single-valued coordinates, e to the minus y is x and e to the minus y twiddle is x twiddle. And here is basically the answer for the supersymmetric vacuum. You get x twiddle square is e to the I twiddle, and x minus e to the I t by x plus minus this epsilon 1 minus epsilon 2, x twiddle is 0. So you can see this is a non-trivial deformation of what we propose as a 0-2 chiral ring for this theory. Note that e twiddle was precisely at the 2-2 locus. So for the second p1, you really have the same quantum cohomology ring, that is x square is infinite on action. But for the first one, if you were to set the deformations to be 0, you actually get back x square equals it for the first p1 as well. But when you have this non-trivial deformation, you have deformed away from this ring structure. And this is rather non-trivial. And this is something which I already told you. So the natural question would be, and this is another something which might be worth pursuing, to generalize to general 0-2 quantum cohomology ring and suggest a possible definition. And let me briefly tell you that one can also consider conformal examples, which are perhaps more interesting from the space-time point of view. Just so let me take p1 times p1, exactly the multiplet structure which I had before, and add to it the following superfields. I add a chiral P and a Fermi gamma with charges minus 2, minus 2 under the first p1 and minus 2, minus 2 under the second p1. So clearly these models will flow to a conformal field theory in the IR, because if you look at the first p1, they had two chiral superfields with charges 1, 1. Now I have added another with charge minus 2, so the sum of charges vanishes, and then it's conformal. And the same for the other p1. And you can actually write down the low-energy nonlinear figure model pretty easily. Is the total space of this O minus 2 line bundle over P1 times P1, where of course this P1 times P1 is given by the vanishing section of P. And you can go through the dualization. I won't bother to go through the details, and construct the vacuum structure. And it turns out that you get Z2 Landau-Ginzburg orbifold conformal field theory for the dual theory. It essentially has to do with the fact that one of the chiral superfields had a charge 2. And there's another minor variation, but it gives you a very drastically different type of vacuum. You can add to this original P1 times P1 a field content, which is P gamma, which is charged under the first P1, and P twiddle gamma twiddle, which is charged only under the second P1. And here the base, the IR theory is again simple. It's a O minus 2 plus O minus 2 line bundle over P1 times P1. And you can again construct the exact vacuum structure. And the dual theory, you can see the vacuum structure very easily in the dual theory. It's actually a Z2 times Z2 orbifold superconformal field theory. I mean, here basically what happens was, essentially, this was coupling the two P1s, so you got a Z2 orbifold, but here the P1s kind of continue to be decoupled, then you get a Z2 times Z2 orbifold superconformal field theory. Okay, so this was the case where the number of chirals was equal to the number of fermions. I guess I don't have too much time to go through the other cases, but I'll nevertheless tell you in some words. So let me consider the cases where the number of chiral superfields was less than the number of fermions. So the generic vacua is isolated, so let's not bother about them. And let me consider an example of a non-generic vacua. So here, basically, here's what I'll do. I'll choose three chiral superfields having U1 charge, 1, 1, and minus 2, and six Fermi superfields having charges in the following way, 1, 1, 1, and minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. You can see it trivially satisfies the gauge anomaly cancellation, because square of the charges gives 6 here, and gives 6 here as well. And of course, the IR theory is a non-compact Labiao with a O minus 2 bundle over this P1. And I take E1 equals E3 for these two guys, and keep E2 distinct, and take E4 equals E5 equals E6. So here, actually, you can work out the details and find that the vacuum equations of the dual theory has no more independent, and it leads to exactly two equations in two variables. And you can actually get a Landau-Ginzburg orbifold superconformal field theory. It turns out it's Z2 because of this charge here. In fact, we went further and constructed cases where E1 equals E2 equals E3, and of course E4 equals E5 equals E6. And this leads to actually even something more drastic. You get just one equation in two variables, and which turns out to be of this following form: it's x1 square plus x2 square plus product x1 x2 is 0. So it's really one complex dimensional surface in this complex x1 x2 space. And it's a Z2 orbifold conformal field theory. I mean, Z2 because you have this choice of plus minus sign here, plus minus sign here. So this product is invariant. So these are non-generic, by the way, these are like completely non-generic examples and require fine-tuning of the parameters appearing in E. And finally, the last case in the remaining time is the case where the number of chiral superfields is greater than the number of Fermi superfields, where you're guaranteed to have a continuum surface as the vacuum in the dual theory. So what is the IR theory, as I told you? It's a zero to nonlinear Stigler model with target space the vacuum manifold. And there's an issue of a singularity here. And here I want to talk about this because it would be clear, better to have a clearer understanding of the singularity and its resolution, which I'll briefly allude to. We can actually construct the Kähler potential. It turns out to be dy square by y plus y bar. As I told you earlier, from the duality map, you see that the real part of y has to be positive semi-definite. So in cases where the yi is continuously flat directions, this yi equals 0 is really a singularity. And the question is, what should you do to resolve this singularity? So we believe this might be associated to some problems which has come up, similar problems in the understanding of 2D black holes, where you actually have a non-trivial shift of the dilaton also, and it diverges precisely at the locus of the metric singularity. So how would you probably expect to see that? For that, because I'm looking at a dilaton, let me actually couple this theory to actually a curved world sheet. Otherwise, this would just vanish. So I start with this theory which I told you about. You have this B squared term and this coupling, and this non-trivial dilaton here, coupled to the world sheet scalar curvature. And here's heuristically which I'll tell you what we expect to happen. So first, if you integrate out this gauge field, it's of course auxiliary, but nonetheless, it's a gauge field, and along the lines of Boucher's work, you get a shift of this dilaton by log of g phi, the metric g phi phi in this direction, which actually tells you the shift is by log of 4 rho square, where rho basically was proportional to g phi phi, rho square. And so now you actually are at a theory at radius 1 over rho, because you're just doing t-duality. Then you actually want to integrate out another one form, this mu. And you expect another shift, which is precisely the same type, but now you're at a radius 1 over rho, and as I told you earlier, phi gets interchanged with a periodic variable theta. And so you expect another shift exactly with phi replaced by theta, but g theta theta is related to 1 over g phi phi, and you get another shift, which is exactly the same, but the opposite sign. So the two shifts cancel. And this is consistent with some results which Hori and Waff actually obtained, where they have only one chiral superfield, and then they see actually there's no shift. But now the question is, when you're constructing more generic zero to compactifications, you can have more than one charge chiral with different charges qi. So what should be the answer for the dilaton shift? And here is what we believe might be the answer. So let me go through it, how you get it. This is, the first part is basically dualizing, integrating out each of the b's, which I told you in the previous transparency. This is a g phi I shift for each direction which you t-dualize on. And then is a overall shift again due to one u1 gauge field. It's 1 by g phi I because you're at the t-dual theory where you're at the inverse radius and they're weighted by the charges. So you can see here you can have a non-trivial shift of the dilaton, and moreover it will blow up when these guys go to zero, which is precisely the case where the real part of y is zero. Hence you see we have a diverging dilaton at the metric singularity. And of course a cleaner derivation of this resolution would be nice. So I guess now I'll just end with my conclusion and some comments. Okay. So I hope I've been able to argue and convince you that zero to duality exists and is a useful arena to study perturbative compactification of the stratus string and as possible tool for model building. But independently, it also should shed some light on aspects of two-dimensional gauge theories with zero to world volume supersymmetry. And clearly, many open questions can be posed. I just listed a few here. Some of them actually did mention during the talk, but let me repeat them again. So as you see, we did this dualization without fluxes turned on. It would be interesting and very important to actually understand this dualization with fluxes. It's also interesting to understand this dualization with a superpotential, because otherwise, there's no way to get, for example, compact labials as target spaces. With non-trivial left-moving gauge fermions left in the IR theory. I mean, you can have compact target spaces, but then it turns out you can do the analysis and find out that all the left-moving fermions are massless and there's just no gauge theory left in the IR dynamics. Then I told you that there can be many branches of vector corresponding to sigma, and this sigma not equals zero, and it would be nice to understand that dynamics. And of course, a cleaner resolution of this metric singularity. Another technical question is fixing these beta IAs exactly. Because, you know, I mean, if you just can't fix these coefficients, I mean, you're really never being able to compute the exact cohomology correction because you need the precise coefficients. Some of them actually might be even zero. Also, the question is, what I told you, can this be thought of as a zero-to generalization of mirror symmetry interchanging Bunny moduli, Taylor structure deformations, and complex structure deformations? And another question would be, what is this zero-to generalization of quantum cohomology ring? And can one use some localization technique to give it a rigorous definition? And finally, of course, even more generally, not only for zero-to duality context, can one try to understand the Wolschitt duality even for non-Kähler compactifications and see what the vacuum structure of this whatever string compactifications would lead to? I guess I'll end here. Thanks.